Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdraber. On today's show, internet governance. Who governs the internet? How much involvement do governments have, like the United States or China or Russia, in determining the standards of the internet, how it's used, who can use it, what websites we can go to? What does it mean, internet governance, this term that's been thrown around the news a lot recently as we debate the United States handing over ultimate control of the domain system to an international body? But we're not going to get bogged down in the IANA transition today. We're going to talk about internet governance as a broader topic. Joining me to discuss this is friend of the show, Shane Tews, visiting fellow at AEI. Welcome back, Shane.
Thank you.
And David Gross, partner at Wiley Ryan, a.k.a. the godfather of internet governance. David, thanks for joining.
Always a pleasure, although I've never been referred to as the godfather before. I always thought that was James Brown, but that's a different issue.
So before we jump in, let's define the term, because unless you've been following the debates for decades, I mean, the internet governance is not necessarily a tech policy topic that has gotten to the kitchen table yet, like encryption. So David, what does internet governance mean to you?
Well, internet governance is a term that's been around now probably about as long as the internet itself, and it's been a changing term. For years, people have been thinking about internet governance really as focusing primarily on things that organizations like ICANN are involved in. That is, how do you allocate domain name addresses and names and things of that nature? But I think people are starting to realize that the term is actually much broader and is somewhat deceptive in the sense that the term internet governance really sounds singular, as if there's one thing, one person, one entity that does this. But as the internet now is intrinsically involved in virtually everything in most people's lives, at least in the developed world and increasingly in the developing world, almost everything that affects the internet and affects people's lives are governed by some laws or norms or others. And internet governance is really now very plural. That is, there are lots of different aspects to it. Governments obviously are involved in internet governance, particularly within their borders. Nonprofit organizations such as ICANN are involved in the domain name piece. Lots of standards organizations have huge impact on the way in which the internet is governed in the sense of the way in which it operates. And individuals obviously are very much involved in it. So if you talk about cybercrime, cybersecurity, and the like, those are part of it. Perhaps best known, however, and where I have many of my scars, is because international organizations get involved in these issues too, whether it's the United Nations or the International Telecommunications Union in Geneva and others as well.
And that's been a big talking point in this debate over ICANN. And just for listeners' edification, ICANN is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. It is a nonprofit that administers the internet's phone book. That's an oversimplification, but we'll take it for that. Essentially, we're talking .com, .net, and then they are also involved when countries when a new country wants a domain name, so let's say South Sudan wants .ss or something like that, they're involved in that decision making. But the big talking point that you hear on both sides is that one way or the other, what no one wants, at least in the United States, is the UN exerting more control over the internet, because the UN is made up of every country in the world that participates in the UN, and many of them are undemocratic. A lot of them do not share the values that America does. The First Amendment is quite unique, and even countries in Europe, even as close as Canada, don't necessarily have the free speech protections that we have in the United States. So you've got people on one side, like Ted Cruz, arguing that if we don't go through with this privatization of the domain name system, it will embolden the ITU. And then you've got folks on the other side, the U.S. government, the Obama administration, saying if we don't do this privatization, it will embolden them. So somehow both sides of the debate are saying that the worst thing that could happen is the UN taking control, and that somehow the other guy's argument is what's going to lead to that. So what is the UN's involvement in the internet? And are there reasons for concern for the average person who's just got a cell phone or a computer?
Well, I think the simple answer is there's always room and good reason to be concerned. The UN has had a number of has had impact in a number of ways, some of which have been positive, some of which has been negative. And I should say the UN has affiliated entities like the International Telecommunications Union, which predates the United Nations, but is an affiliated organization of the United Nations. So they are tied together very closely in that sense. But the UN does, let me first start by saying something positive. That's usually a good way to begin. The UN has been played a positive role with certain internet-related issues. So, for example, one of the keys to the development of economic and political and social development of people around the world is through the internet, the exchange of information, the ability to sell goods across borders, exchange information. And the United Nations and its affiliated organizations have, by and large, been very much a part of that in recognizing that the key to a better life for people around the world is the internet. Having said that, many governments would like to see the UN exert greater control over things for which we don't agree, such as political issues and the like, the ability of people to speak, to listen on political and other sensitive matters. And the UN has been, I think, by and large, reflecting the views of many of its members, certainly not in the forefront of the types of free flow of information that the United States has long been a part of.
And correct me if I'm wrong, there was an instance in recent memory where some type of vote happened at the ITU and the United States was a little caught off guard by just how few countries agreed with us and our values and what we think the internet should be, and how maybe it was something like 2/3 of the members of the ITU wanted more control over the internet and more government involvement. And part of the reason we are so concerned about the UN is that if you put it up for, a democratic vote, for lack of a better word, and just let every country vote, the outcome might not be so great.
Let me begin by saying that President Putin from Russia has been very explicit on this, and I listen and watch him with great interest, as you can imagine.
Because he's going to be our next vice president?
Well, largely because he often means what he says and says what he means, and he has been explicit, very explicit, in his interest in having internet governance-related issues, and by that he really means ICANN and related organizations, be controlled by the International Telecommunications Union and the United Nations. So that should be a signal. It's a good marketplace signal of what their intentions are in governments like Russia's in terms of their view about how to control internet-related speech and the like. The meeting that you refer to was a meeting in Dubai back in about 2014 or so. I'm sorry, 2012. And it was a meeting of the International Telecommunication Union in which they were evaluating whether or not a treaty, a 1988 treaty, should be revised in a way that arguably could increase the jurisdiction of the ITU with regard to some internet-related issues. And I will say the United States was not taken by surprise. I was not leading that delegation. I led the delegations during the Bush 43 administration. So I was there, but I was not leading the U.S. delegation. But having said that, the U.S. delegation was not at all surprised, and the leadership of the U.S. delegation and back here in Washington were not surprised by what the attempts by governments to expand the jurisdiction of the ITU regarding the internet. But rather, I would say actually they spoke with great passion, and I supported their views that it should not happen. They were very strong in that. And 54 other countries agreed with the United States and refused to sign that treaty. Now, a majority of countries that were there did agree to sign it, and that's troublesome. And it does show you the breakdown in terms of the divisions within the world, amongst governments at least, on these issues. But much of Europe, the UK and much of Europe, as well as the United States and Australia and other governments, Canada and Japan and so forth, stood very firm in not agreeing to that jurisdictional reach.
And does that indicate what the incentives are for those two types of countries? You know, the United States benefits greatly from the digital economy, as does Europe, Australia, free trade, free speech. We do not have the type of political turmoil that you see in some other countries. Are these other 100 or so countries mostly worried about cracking down on protesters? I mean, is that what's primarily motivating them, is a desire to control the flow of information, and they're not necessarily thinking about things like trade and the economy?
I think it's as often is, and I realize we're trying to paint here with too broad a brush to be clear about it, but different countries have very different motives, and different governments have very different motives. So, for example, clearly Russia tries to find a set of rules and a role for the Russian government that would give it priority in terms of trying to suppress political dissonance and speech. China has some of the same characteristics. They are perhaps a little more complicated in some respects because they have experimented more within China about the ability to use blogging and things of that nature to express, and that's had some interesting political ramifications within China. But China, of course, still has the Great Firewall and is still very, very active in repressing the free speech or the transfer of information across the borders and so forth. Europe has a complex series of both economic and speech-related rules and laws that are different than here in the United States. I do think it's fair to say that the United States continues to be unique in its view of the relationship between the First Amendment values and the use of the internet and for speech and for other purposes.
You mentioned earlier how because of the way the internet is today, it affects everyone, and these decisions that are happening at these bodies that people have never heard of are going to impact listeners who do not have the power necessarily to remove people at the ITU through voting, or that they're not accountable to elections. And we've got a meeting next month, the WTSA, and because I forgot to write down what that stands for, I will let you say what that acronym is.
It stands for the World Telecommunications Standardization Assembly. It's a once every 4 year conference, major conference, global conference held by the International Telecommunications Union that for many decades has really focused on technical issues about the way in which telephones and telephone equipment has been standardized in a global way.
And that's to make sure basic things like when I travel to Europe or to Asia or wherever, that my cell phone that was manufactured for the purpose of maybe primary purpose of being used in the United States can still work in other places, so that basically the idea that we want equipment to work with other equipment. But now, as we discussed before the show, it's getting a little bit more complicated than that.
Indeed. In fact, I would say even more than people going from point A to point B with their phones, predating cell phones, the primary purpose was that you could actually connect a call between here and, to continue your analogy, South Sudan or China or Russia, so that the networks were interoperable, that the technical characteristics worked with each other. And as you can imagine, that's a very important, very technical set of issues that have been that's been around for a long time.
So looking at this meeting, you know, as the godfather of internet governance, as Shane so generously calls you.
It's true.
And Shane, if he's the godfather, what are you?
I'm a disciple.
Well, that's good. Oh, boy. Are you the only disciple?
Is this there's a lot of us.
This is probably where I need to leave. That's the
Well, Godfather, since this is the day of your daughter's wedding and I can ask you for a favor, I will ask you for one. What are you worried about coming out of this meeting? I mean, we talked about how this whole thing about IANA and the domain name system and the phone book, that's just one aspect of internet governance. I mean, what are the things that concern you as someone who's been in this space? As these countries meet and they discuss things at the WTSA conference, what keeps you up at night?
Well, yeah, a lot of things need and should be discussed. And the first question really is, what are we talking about and where is the appropriate place for those issues to be discussed? The ITU does play an important role. Let me be very clear about that. It is the place globally where issues about radio spectrum are decided. And because radio spectrum does not recognize borders between countries, it is very important that when we deal with satellites and spectrum for cell phones, as you pointed out, and things of that nature, that it be done in a way that works from a global perspective, at least to the extent humanly possible.
Yeah, because the borders on a map are not going to constrain the airwaves.
Exactly. And so it is critically important, and therefore the United States has long been a supporter of the ITU and continues to be, as long as it's focusing on the things that are beneficial for us and for mankind. Having said that, there is always a natural tendency by any organization, in my experience, to try to get involved in things that are newer, sexier, more interesting, perhaps, than what they have been doing before. And obviously the internet fits that set of characteristics pretty clearly. And so we've seen a rise in the involvement of not just the ITU, but other international organizations, including the UN in New York and elsewhere, to try to get involved in deciding issues that are perhaps best left for others, either the private sector or individual governments, or nonprofit organizations that come together voluntarily to decide issues in a non-jurisdictionally expanding way, if I can use that term. So what keeps me up at night in terms of the ITU is that I'm always concerned, as I am with other organizations, that it start to get involved in areas, particularly as it's an intergovernmental organization, that is best left to others to deal with. Sometimes that's standards-related issues. The ITU now, through this assembly that will be held in October in Tunisia, may well be looking at issues having to do with cybersecurity. There are even proposals having to do with what, in essence, are cybercrime, which the ITU has really no expertise and jurisdiction about. It has to do with issues about the Internet of Things and some unhelpful areas like that. And even on things that some people believe could, in the future, work to basically replace the DNS, the domain name system that we know today, in ways that could either be inconsistent or perhaps more likely to be an overlap to it, that could be viewed down the road as giving governments a much greater set of tools to monitor people and things in ways that would inhibit free speech and the free flow of information.
And the concern there is that the ITU is an intergovernmental body, and it's not the multi-stakeholder body that we've seen in other areas of internet governance. So Shane, I'd like you to jump in because you've been involved with the Internet Governance Forum for a long time. And can you just briefly explain what the Internet Governance Forum is and why it's important?
Well, that's also been a challenge, and David's been there from the beginning of trying to find the right format and place for people to have discussions that are they're interdisciplinary. So it allows the engineers to talk to the businessmen, but it also allows them to talk to the governments that are there. There was a case where when we were in Egypt, where I remember the ambassador from Canada grabbing the guy from Cisco and also grabbing a business person he thought had an issue, and they worked it out in the hallway. And that's not something that you normally see in an ITU setting where it's just completely government-driven dialogue. And so it's a unique structure that David was one of the key people that brought it together, because he realized that the internet doesn't run on standards. The internet runs on basically good ideas put together by engineers, and then they move forward with the idea that it's always the best current effort. And if you come up with something better, they move to the next best effort. And the way to do that is to not have it baked into a regulatory process.
And the stakeholders include not just governments. It's civil society groups like Tech Freedom. It's experts like yourselves. It's human rights advocates. It's companies. I mean, isn't that the value of multi-stakeholder, that it gets beyond the interests of government, which might be very opposed to the interests of the private sector or human rights advocates?
The term multi-stakeholder is a terrible term. I think almost everybody would agree who's a part of it.
Part of the problem is it doesn't translate in certain languages, which is a challenge.
And even those of us who are native English speakers have trouble understanding exactly what people mean by multi-stakeholder, other than the fact, the obvious fact, that decisions ought to be made by some group of interested stakeholders, more than one being governments usually, that would come together and play whatever relevant role they are able to play. So it can be academics, it can be governments, it can be individuals, it can be companies, it can be nonprofits, and the like, depending on what the issue is. But it does not necessarily at all translate, and people often misunderstand this, at least to my way of thinking, that everyone is equal. In fact, everyone is not equal. Better ideas have greater weight, and those who would express ideas that work usually are given much more credibility than those people who just show up at meetings and want to hear themselves speak.
So you've got so many unresolved issues in internet governance. I mean, some of the ones that I've seen in the materials you sent me were cybersecurity. I mean, that's a huge one, because we have rules on the books in international law about what constitutes a war, what constitutes an attack. It generally involves death, damage, destruction, something physical that we can appreciate. But you've had cyber attacks that, while they create physical damage, like the Stuxnet attack, the U.S., at least rumored U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear facilities pre-Iran nuclear deal, You've got things like that that are not defined. You've got completely varying protections on human rights and free speech all over the world. You've got issues where countries want to localize the internet so that you don't have one internet. I have an internet in China, I've got one in Russia, and I control what comes in and out. Do you have a sense of where you would like to see things go? I mean, we know where Putin wants to take things, but where would the Godfather like to see things go?
Well, putting that term to one side quickly, of course. I think the key here, again, to go back to one of my initial comments, is I think often people make a mistake, although it's very human, to think of a singular place to resolve these issues. They are going to get resolved through a variety of forums. And I think the key here is different governments, different groups have to figure out for themselves, based on what issue they're talking about, what the most appropriate one is. And it's usually, even for a given issue, it'll be multiple places. So, for example, some of these issues will be decided in a bilateral setting where certain countries' governments get together and decide what laws apply, because governments make laws. Others come together as standard organization to figure out what the relationship is. To follow up on Shane's excellent point, the key to the internet to date has been, at its heart, in almost all respects, it is voluntarily done. That is, the domain name system and other parts of it are done not because people have to do it, but because people want to do it and they find value in doing it. And part of the problem that I'm sure you've looked at in previous podcasts and elsewhere of the IANA transition and what happens if it doesn't go through in a smooth fashion is that this voluntary set of relationships can easily be torn asunder because there is no requirement that they operate the way they operate.
And that's how it's easy to take the internet for granted, because it works. My connection works 99.something% of the time. I get the services I want. And that partly is because I live in the United States. But it's easy to forget that it is a bunch of people who do this on a day-to-day basis. And if they decide one day not to, things would look very different.
Exactly. And they do it some do it truly for altruistic reasons, which is really quite extraordinary in this day. But
like a lot of people who edit Wikipedia articles.
but also largely because people find value in doing it and because the value exceeds the cost for them of doing it. That's how most people make decisions in their lives. But if that equation starts to change and the costs, the personal costs, the financial costs, the societal costs, start to grow and the problems and the difficulties of doing it continue to get worse and the value does not increase commensurately, then you'll find people going, companies going, organizations leaving, starting to do their own thing, looking for safe havens. And of course, the great promise of the internet that we have not fulfilled yet is how truly global it can be. We only have a little less than half of the world on the internet. That's a remarkable achievement in such a short period of time. But that also means we've got a ways to go, and everyone recognizes that. We should be thinking of ways of making that easier, not harder, to accomplish.
And part of that is to figure out how to bring cybersecurity into the next generation of the internet. So to do more mobile banking, especially for places that the unbanked, that use their phone as a banking system in underdeveloped countries, that you want an element of trust, which right now we have a lot of just innate trust in the way the internet works. Even engineers will tell you that, which always makes lawyers kind of, concerned.
They like a little bit more certainty.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily exist there, except we've all trusted the system to date. And so as we build it out, we need to be thinking about the trust but verify, trust but authenticate. And we do have the tools in our hands right now. Your mobile phone number can basically identify you throughout the system, and you could be using that for multiple issues. You could also do that on your web browser. But we need to make sure that we're allowing that in, so you do have companies that trust us along the way and they don't start to separate out and create a separate internet pathway.
Let me just add to Shane's excellent points, something that I think is underappreciated in terms of thinking through these things. It is very natural for people to think in terms of laws to protect people and laws to try to promote certain things that are societally beneficial.
Yeah, part of that's free speech, the First Amendment. Why do I get to wake up every morning and tweet whatever the hell I want about the president? It's because there is a law there that allows me to do that and prevents the government from retaliating.
Exactly. And so it's very natural, therefore, for people to think we should establish a set of laws and regulations, both here and globally, that would work to try to enhance the sorts of things we've been talking about. One of the dangers of that, one of the very substantial dangers that I think is underappreciated, is whenever you start to try to do that, you basically take as a given the current architecture and nature of what it is that you're trying to promote and regulate. One of the lessons of the internet is that if you went back 50 years, using an artificial time frame here, nobody, except for maybe a couple of people like Bob Kahn and Vint Cerf and so forth, would even have been thinking about what is now we take for granted, which is the internet.
Right.
And even they will tell you, of course, that when they put it together for academic purposes and defense-related purposes, no one ever thought it would be what it is today. It was a confluence of remarkable things. If you, and therefore the internet has in many respects replaced the telephony networks that had been around for 100 years. It didn't happen because government said it should happen. It didn't happen because somebody woke up one day and said, hey, wouldn't it be great if we had this internet thing and we just basically rewired in many respects the whole world in way in which we communicate and so forth. It happened. And so it's very important if you ask computer scientists and others, in 100 years from now, will we still have the domain name system that we have today? They look at you like you're insane. They say, of course not. We will. It'll be something different.
Yeah.
So, but nobody knows what that new thing will be, what that new internet thing will be. My guess is, but it's only a guess, of course, is that it'll be something that would have security more baked in some fashion while still allowing for free flow of information and not allowing people to be monitored in the same way that could happen through a more ubiquitous system.
So is that one of the biggest challenges, that the internet was not built with security in mind because it was hard to foresee something like the DNC hack or tampering with elections or stealing money and all these things? Like, the Vint Cerf didn't have that in his mind. They were thinking, we want people to have more information. So is that now the challenge, is we already have the internet, it was not built with security in mind, and now with something like the Internet of Things, Shane and I talked in a previous podcast, security by design, is that a big imperative for the study groups at the ITU and internet governance entities going forward, figuring out how can we deal with the challenges of cybersecurity, political dissent, and all those things without destroying what we have now, but without preventing something better from coming in the future?
You know, the origins of the internet, which are much written about and discussed.
Al Gore, obviously.
are fascinating. And to go back to the security point, quite reasonably, of course they did not bake security in, because everybody on the network was known to everybody else. It was that small. Even I now remember, I'm old enough to remember, that when it started to become more commercialized, when people actually started to do commercial-related things, it was considered so outrageous, so contrary to the reason the internet at that stage existed, that you would get what they called flamed. People would just attack you for doing those types of things. Instead, it was supposed to be used purely to exchange useful information and the like. So obviously the internet has changed dramatically since then. And there have been lots of technical efforts to try to bake security in, people talking about Internet 2, a number of things. The lesson I take away from that is these things are very hard to do consciously. I'm very optimistic that they will be done over time because they will end up being better, but not because a single government or a single group mandates it. That's really hard to do.
And you have a challenge with attribution. So that's a double-edged sword. There are times when you don't want to be attributed to because you want people to have the ability to have freedom of expression. But that also means that we don't exactly know who does certain attacks, because they have the ability to obfuscate who they are as the way the network runs, and the ability to, you know, use multiple networks via Tor or something similar to that.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining today. We certainly have a lot of things to look out for next month as the meeting happens, and maybe there will be some talking points for us to debate on the show again as we see what happens with all these challenges like cybersecurity, free speech, human rights, et cetera, and as we see what the role of governments will be going forward. Any parting thoughts before we sign off?
Let me just say, thank you very much for the invitation to participate. I've really enjoyed it and I've looked forward to doing this with you. Second is that the issues, as complicated and as difficult as they are today, and they are all very complicated, very difficult issues, will become even more complex and, if I may suggest, even more difficult going forward. The players continue to expand. The importance of the internet continues to expand, and therefore its effect on people's lives continue to change and to grow. So these issues will not only stay with us, it'll continue. They will continue to evolve. Their importance will continue to grow. And the number of people who want to play in this space and will need to be playing in this space will continue to grow.
Yeah, I think continued engagement by all entities, not just end users or producers of equipment or somebody who's managing this going forward, everybody needs to be engaged. And sometimes your government does represent you, and sometimes you need to represent yourself.
Well, we'll leave it there. My guests have been David Gross, partner at Wiley Ryan and the godfather of internet governance. Godfather, thank you for joining.
I was going to go, yow, but I shouldn't do that.
And also joining is friend of the show, Shane Tews, and consigliere to the Godfather, visiting fellow at American Enterprise Institute. Shane, thanks for joining.
Happy to be here.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Feel free to pitch topics and guests or other ideas or feedback. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app. Please leave us a review because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.